read them off and then ask the service if they wanted to make any comment on that. And then, depending on the council's appetite, we have a long list of motions we can start to go through. But let's go through that first. The first of the items was the submission of the final ops plan by September 1 rather than December 1. Second was the prohibition of sectors carrying over unused TAC into the next fishing year. I'm wrong in that the committee has taken some action on that. I think that the service may want to make some comments on that. The third is, can permits in confirmation of permit history apply for sector membership? And the fourth is the exiting a sector and what penalty will occur if a sector disbands after exceeding its TAC. I would ask Pat if she had wanted to make some comments on those. At least the first one might have some impact on a motion if we get to that.
I'm a little unclear, I guess. Comments because we're going to take motions to address them?
Certainly on the first one, we if we get to it, we will have a motion that essentially indicates that the ops plans be submitted by December 1st. Rather than your request of September 1st. We're not at the motion part of it, but I just didn't know whether you wanted to comment in general on any of those things or whether there were other items that we did not address at all in your letter.
Well, I'm not sure exactly how to handle this. There are... in addition to the items that you've listed that haven't been addressed or haven't at least yet been addressed, there were several items that we were concerned about how they were addressed and wouldn't agree with what the committee concluded. We can do that as the motions come up, or we could provide that comment back to the council before the next committee meeting. It's up to you, Mr. Chairman.
If you want to hold comment till we get to the motions, I didn't know whether your comments might allow us to modify some of the motions ahead of time, but we can do that during the process. Okay, we will move ahead on some of the motions. We will start. They will follow pretty much in the order of the document number 2, which is the draft sector management measures. We would start out with the sector administration. I will put out the Tom.
I didn't mean to interrupt. I just was trying to flag you to give me a chance when you got to the stopping point.
Okay, what I thought I might do is put the two committee motions for this sector up on the board, and then we can have discussion on it, and we'll start it off with your comments. Okay. The two committee motions we have was that, one, all vessels with a limited access multi-species permit can join a groundfish sector. And the second motion is, in formation of a sector, sector participants can select who may participate in the sector. It's in document number 2. Essentially, these are on page 1. The actual motions are not there. If you look, They're encompassed in the shaded area of that, and they're not worded in the same words as the motions. The motions are the committee motions.
Yeah, maybe I can help clear this up a little bit. The committee's made a number of motions over the last 6 or 8 months. Many of those motions have not been brought fully to the council yet. At the committee meeting in December, the committee asked that in preparation of this meeting, we bring forward a document that sort of summarizes all the work that's been done. Lori worked on that, and she developed Enclosure 2. And what she did is she basically took what was in existence in Amendment 13 for sectors and then altered it or modified it based on the actions that the committee has taken to date, none of which, obviously, the council, much of which the council has not voted on. So in the document that you have in front of you, Enclosure 2, she highlighted either the specific language in shading where the change was made, or in some instances where an entire section is new, she might have just highlighted the title section so you understand that, you know, for the most part, that whole section is done. And then what the motions that RIP is bringing forward have all been pulled out of various committee meeting summaries, and they address these points. So, for example, in the shaded section under H3, the last two sentences, in the formation of a sector, sector participants can select who may participate. And then the next line, all vessels with a limited access multi-species permit are eligible to join a sector. During the course of the discussion, that matches up with these two motions. A little bit of explanation about those. During the course of the discussion, if you go back and read Amendment 13, there's a lot of language in Amendment 13 that says, you know, sectors are voluntary, they're self-selecting, which most people have always interpreted to mean the people organizing a sector. This is a business arrangement. You can choose who can participate in your sector. But there was some question about that at the committee meeting, so the committee meeting passed a motion to say, look, let's make it clear that sectors can choose who their participants are. And then with respect to the limited access multi-species permit, once again, the regulatory language says if you have a limited access multi-species permit, you can join a sector. But there were questions raised about, okay, what if someone doesn't have any history, doesn't have any days at sea, can they still join a sector? What about hand gear A permits, which are technically limited access permits now, but they don't have any days at sea? And so, once again, the committee passed a motion that made it clear that, in their opinion, anyone with a limited access multi-species permit can join a sector. This is just trying to make clear two points that there were some questions raised about it.
Pat. So the outstanding clarification then is how the CPA should fit into this, I think. I think it's a policy call that the council needs to make. Clearly, there are different implications if a confirmation of permit histories are allowed to be part of sectors, because you're potentially activating activity permits that have been inactive in some cases for quite a long time. So there are conservation implications that need to be at least part of the discussion. And at the same time, there are also some equity considerations, because it does provide some opportunity for people who perhaps have put permits in CPHs waiting for an opportunity to be able to activate them.
Yeah, I remember this kind of like a discussion about thinking about CPHs, and to me that if somebody has a permit in CPH, they have a right to activate it today, and they decide to move that permit once they activate it into a sector that's under a hard TAC, then I don't know if there's, I can't see that there's under any issues of increasing the capacity, because they only got awarded what they actually caught. So maybe a boat's been in CPH for 5 years, and if we pick a 10-year period, then they probably don't have a lot of landings. But in any event, as long as the other participants in the sector want them in there, then they're under the high TAC that's awarded to that sector. So there should be, it should be, what we say, neutral as far as conservation goes.
I think it depends on when they had the CPH and when the period is that you determine how the allocations. So that's a possibility, certainly. But I think there can be a mismatch between the two.
Does anybody know how many permits, maybe Doug knows, how many permits, I guess you never know, are there, that are in CPH that would qualify for an A-Day? Because that's another qualification. You have to have an A-Day.
Yes, it's something we can determine, but don't have the numbers here.
Dave, Gaetan?
I think my question was going to be similar, that if somebody has a permit in confirmation permit history and it's been there since, hasn't been activated since before 1996, where are they going to stand in this program? They don't have, the only thing they would really have is capacity if we pick the one of the capacity alternatives, one of the ones that includes some fraction of capacity. If it's a straight catch history thing, and catch history is determined from 96 on, they get nothing, right? So, we ought to be up front and let people know that. You get nothing. So it may be an irrelevant question. I mean, they only have one place to go, and that's the open access pool. So, you know, I'm not sure we got to spend a lot of time beating ourselves up about it, because it may already be self-determined.
Tom?
Yeah, staff and I, NIMF staff and I had at least an exchange about this. I'm not sure we'd call it a discussion, but it seems that my interpretation of what the committee has passed so far doesn't place any limits on limited access permits that can join sectors. So that my interpretation would be that if the language stands as written now, that a CPH permit could join a sector. We haven't put any restrictions on it. So I think if the council wants to put restrictions on it or decides they're useful, then they ought to change that to make it clear that that's the way. The other thing I'd like to point out is that I'd have to check with Eric, who did all the analysis, but I believe that when he did the analyses, he included all permits because he used something called the moratorium right ID. He used all the permits that exist, whether they're in CPH or not. He probably did the analyses to include all eligible permits, whether they were in the CPH category or not. And I think Dave Gaethel correctly highlighted the time it's potentially an issue is for someone who hasn't fished at all during your qualification period, and if you choose an allocation system that uses capacity as an element, well, then here's a permit that doesn't have any landings history at all during the period, but he gets a piece of every stock. And that's just an indication. You know, that is an example. When we look at the data, we see permits with no landing history that do get pieces of the stock when we do those analyses. So, you know, you do wind up distributing it, and that may be an equity question that the council wants to deal with. But, you know, as been pointed out, there'd probably have to, if you decide not to allow them, there'd probably have to be some way to figure out what date you're using as to when the CPH becomes a disqualifying factor. Whether it's, I have to think through that more rather than talk out loud, but I'm sure that we'd have to define somehow the period of CPH that applies, because there are boats, quite honestly, who have, at least some boats, that have moved in and out of the CPH category during the period 96 to 2006. It's not clear to me that you want to preclude anyone who was ever in the CPH category from being in here. You may decide you want to preclude people that were in there at some period or not.
John Nelson.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. When I was going through this, quite frankly, I was getting a little confused, and I'd gone back to the original title page, and it said the shaded headings and text highlights are new sections and or sections that have been changed significantly from the Amendment 13 document, which that's fine. However, it seems to me that it's not clear on what is changed in the shaded area from the policies that we've adopted for sectors. You know, when I read it, I think the first sentence, for example, I think it sounds like it's what we had as far as policy. But that refers to who can get into a sector as somebody who's been granted a TAC, for example, just using that as an example. And then does that provide the sidebars that the Groundfish Committee should be operating from? So I guess the question is, in their deliberations of all of these shaded areas that we're going to be going through, did the Groundfish Committee utilize the policy that was adopted, not just Amendment 13 guidelines that were out there?
Tom?
Well, I kind of glossed over this first shaded section. The very first sentence is the exact policy of definition of a sector that was adopted by the Sector Policy Committee. That definition differs slightly from the definition that was in Amendment 13. So this section modifies the definition of a groundfish sector to match the one adopted by the sector policy. The sector policy, I don't believe, is specific about who can join a sector. So this is a supplement that was voted on that says, I'm sorry, not who can join a sector, but that sector participants can choose. This is a supplement. And I don't think it's also specific about what participants in the fishery can join the sector, and that's the limited access permit provision that I mentioned.
Okay, and thanks, Tom. And I hope that when we go through the other shaded areas that we also reflect on what was policy and is there a significant change from what policy is? Because I think in some of them it seems like it's contrary to what we passed as policy. But in this particular one, the definition talked about participants who had been granted a TAC. And then in the last sentence of the new shaded area, it says all vessels with a limited access permit. And that seems to be much more expansive than what the definition called for. And I know we've been talking about the permit history and whatnot, and is it clear that we're still talking about people that actually would be eligible for a TAC because they have the history? Or is it anybody can participate in a sector, no matter what time frame we're talking about? And they wouldn't, even though they wouldn't be eligible for a allocation of a TAC.
Tom?
Well, I read the definition of sector a little differently. Maybe I'm misreading it, but the sector is not a group of people who's been granted a TAC. The TAC is granted to the sector. The definition doesn't say only. First off, we've often said that our sectors don't grant TACs to individuals. The TAC is allocated to the sector, not to the individuals. And so I read this as saying, okay, a sector is a group of people who have been granted a TAC, meaning the sector is granted to the sector as a group, not to people as individuals. I mean, that's how it's been read and interpreted for the last 8 months.
Yeah. And I don't disagree. That's true. But we all, when we were developing that, at least as I understood it, it was you developed the TAC or whatever is going to be assigned to the sector was based on what people could contribute to that. And therefore they all had some history within a certain time frame. Now, that's what I understood is how it was being done. Now, this broadens it so that anyone could come in, which I don't necessarily object to, but I just wanted to make sure that we understood that it seems to be a broadening of what the definition was. I could be correct.
The actual definition of a sector in the policy that we adopted says a sector means a group of persons holding limited access vessel permits. who have voluntarily entered into a contract and agreed to fishing certain restrictions for a specified period of time, and which has been granted a TAC or tax in order to achieve objectives consistent with applicable FMP goals and objectives. So the actual definition of a sector in the policy doesn't say that the individuals are allocated a TAC or have to bring a TAC to the sector. It says it's people with a limited access permit form an organization or a group, and then that group is allocated a portion of the TAC or all the TACs, and they have an operations plan that binds them together. So I think what you're getting hung up on is whether or not a boat can join a sector or a vessel permit can join a sector if it doesn't have a TAC.
What I was getting hung up on is it was not clear to me on what was the language, because I don't have it in front of me right now, of what the policy was and what is being proposed to modify the definition of what we already had for a sector. And I, you know, thank you for, you know, reading it and clarifying it for me. But that's what I think the problem is, probably for everybody, and since I had some intimate contact with this development of the sector definitions and whatnot, as we go through this, it's going to be somewhat problematic if you don't have what is the recommendation or the guidance that was suggested, or in the i.e. then policy of what the sector committee developed. You don't know what's being modified, and if there are major changes or are they nuances. I don't have a handle on that, and that's problematic, I think.
So with respect to document 2, which is what we're talking about right now, you don't have the benefit, nor does anyone in the council, of having a side-by-side or a notation that says this change is being recommended, or this change is occurring as a result of the policy we adopted on sectors, or this change is a change that the committee is recommending. You'd like to see the distinction or the differentiation. Okay. We're not going to be able to produce that today, but I know Lori is here. I think, Lori, you put together document number 2. I would expect that this document is the beginning of, we're going to continue to adapt this document. We're going to build on this document. Is it possible for you to identify those changes that are consistent with the policy that we adopted, or changes that are or identify changes that are recommended through committee action? Do you understand what I'm asking?
Yes, I can do that. All of the changes are recommended by the committee. So what I can do is note which ones are consistent with the sector policy.
Okay. We have a motion on the board. Any further questions or discussion? In the audience, Maggie?
Thank you. There is one other issue on this eligibility to join a sector that I've brought to the council's attention, and it would be helpful if we just got a yes or no answer to the question. We have some vessel owners who have groundfish, combination groundfish monkfish permits, and they also own monkfish only permits. They want to put the groundfish monkfish permits in the sector, and at such time as when, if and when the monkfish plan is amended to allow sectors and monkfish, they'd like to bring those permits into the same sector in order to, you know, that's their sector. They don't want to have to form a new sector. And so I don't want to have to be in a situation where we have to amend the groundfish plan again to allow that possibility in the future. So I'm just wondering if there's some way we can say if and when the monkfish plan is amended to allow for monkfish sectors, that monkfish and groundfish sectors can be joint sectors, can be the same, you know, people with monkfish-only permits can be in a groundfish-monkfish sector.
You're asking for the council to make something easy for you? Not that
I just say yes or no. If you say no, then we'll figure out some, you know, have to figure out another way to do it. But it just seems to be a logical thing to do. And
Tom?
I told Gene to close his ears, but I just tell Maggie, just don't tell us. I mean, quite honestly, as long as a boat without a groundfish permit is not fishing for groundfish, what do we care what the contract looks like in the private industry? I mean, maybe that's too glib an answer, but that's actually an answer that I wanted to pass to her before when she first asked the question. You know, I mean, realistically, all the groundfish plan is concerned about is that if you're going to fish for groundfish, you have a groundfish limited access permit, and you're fishing either inside or outside a sector. If you're in a sector and you have a groundfish limited access permit, we don't care if you go fish for groundfish. If you're in a sector and you don't have a groundfish limited access permit and you don't fish for groundfish, what do we care? You know, as long as that permit isn't fishing for groundfish, I'm not sure I can really see that it would somehow matter to the council. But maybe I'm missing something here.
Could I just, it's only because it says all vessels with a limited access multi-species permit are eligible to join, and I don't know if that limits that to just those permits or not, because if it doesn't, then Tom's right. You know, I can go away on this one issue. Wouldn't that be nice?
I guess I'm missing something because I'm reading document 2, page 1, the second shaded section under H3. The sector means a group of persons holding limited access vessel permits.
Keep reading.
See, I think people are missing the point here, or the point, maybe I'm missing the point. But my interpretation is, right, we want to know who's in a groundfish sector. We say that only limited access vessel permits can be in a groundfish sector. They're the ones who may or may not bring history to the sector. They're the ones who go fish for groundfish. That's what we want to know. So Maggie sends us, or whatever her sector is, sends us a list of all the groundfish permits that are in the groundfish sector that are going to fish for groundfish or bring history, maybe not fish for groundfish. But if, you know, I mean, on the side, she's got a contract. Basically, that's what this is, that this is some contract between that group and they allow somebody in who doesn't have a groundfish permit. Why does she even have to tell us? We're not letting them fish for groundfish. They're not contributing to the history of the plan. If they just want to be there so that organizationally it's easier for them someday when monkfish can form, that then they can sit the paperwork for a monkfish plan. Do we really have an interest in that type of activity? And, you know, I thought about this a little bit, and I don't really see where we do have an interest in that. But, once again, maybe I'm missing something here. Well, that's why I said, just don't tell us.
Well, a couple of things. I go back to that last sentence, the one that I missed, and it says all vessels. It doesn't say only vessels with a limited access multi-species permit. But then it just says sector. It doesn't say multi-species sector. Also, I don't – if that line is interpreted the way that you think it's interpreted, then I don't believe you're going to be able to get a roster through NIMS that has a vessel without a limited access multi-species permit. And to the point about making a side contract, I don't know how you could transfer quota in and out of a sector unless the council allows interspecies FMP or sectors in different FMPs to transfer quota. We haven't even gotten to that issue yet. But to Maggie's point, if she has monkfish boats that want to sign into a groundfish authorized sector in the groundfish FMP, then this language needs to be clarified so that it's just limited access permits, and not specific to what type of limited access permit.
So you'll figure out how to do it.
I will. Well,
someone will. I had some suggested language, but I don't know if that. No, if nobody has any objection to it, Tom and I can figure out how to do it.
Jim Odlin.
Yeah, I think what Maggie's asking is a little bit bigger than first meets the eye. I think what Maggie's saying is when and if the monkfish plan allows the formation of sectors, can a sector, can we allow the multi-species sector to act as an umbrella, so to speak, for a monkfish sector to avoid the people for doing all the double work that they need to do to have monkfish and groundfish kind of combined in one sector? And I would say it would take just a simple, yes, this will allow, we will allow the multi-species sector to act as an umbrella for a monkfish sector in the future if they're formed. Then we've pushed it over to the monkfish committee to do their thing and decide whether they want or don't want sectors formed. And if they do want them formed, then the multi-species sector can be the umbrella for a monkfish sector. I think I explained that. So they don't have to hire another manager. They don't have to, it's all under this umbrella.
I know what you're asking about. I'm just saying, and not to whether I think it's a good or bad idea. I'm just saying I don't think the language is clear enough. But that's my point. Paul Howard?
We started to discuss this, and we're going to bring back a white paper to the council in February about the joining more than one sector. And then we get off about how this might be a way not to join more than one sector, but bring other fisheries into the groundfish sector. And we started talking about, well, what if the scallop fishery has sectors and they want some more yellowtail? And then so a boat out in New Bedford that targets yellowtail all the time that also has, there could be bycatch concerns. In other words, he gives the yellowtail or sells the yellowtail to the sector, but then goes off and targets something else that may have bycatch. So you've created a problem. So it really isn't conservation neutral. And it's more difficult to administer. It could be. Anyway, there were some issues that we decided, let's see how sectors go first before we start, you know, talking about the various combinations of different fisheries and different sectors and multiple transfers between fisheries. And we've got a lot more work to do with that. I don't know if you could address all the concerns, but.
Tom? Not you, Tom, the other Tom. Yeah, you, Tom, not that Tom.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted, now, the prior main motion that we went through with the alternatives for allocation had only the fellas with the A days that had days left still on their license. This one refers to limited access multi-species permit that may just be people with a C day. Or a limited access permit with no days left. Now, our problem on the island being the absence of fish for so many years, 17, 18 years, since 89, 90, 91, we haven't had fish. I was hoping, when this motion was originally made at the Groundfish Advisory, it didn't have the limited access in front of the word multi-species, because all people with a multi-species permit can join a groundfish sector. And I thought that was a ray of hope. Quickly squelched as the motion was amended to make it a limited access holder only. And our vision of it for our fishing community on the island was that many people had suggested permit banking as a possible solution to our future participation in the fishery. And I was thinking, well, if we got a little core of permits and a little batch of history and we could convince people to invest in shares of a stock that doesn't exist yet and acquire some history for a fish that is not yet in our waters, which seems like a far-fetched thing to try to attempt, though we are undeterred, of course. I wouldn't see any problem. I mean, a sector operates under a hard tack. We're a hook-and-line fishing community, predominantly. Some guys use hand-operated tub trawls. the only permits that we can get now are open access ones, and we have guys with days at sea with no days and sea days that are unusable. I didn't see that there should be a problem with them being in a sector. They'll be operating under a hard tack. It would enable our permit banking plan to be more viable in that we could let the young guys in and partake of whatever history that the community might acquire or purchase or perhaps be granted under a community fishing allocation, such as they have on the West Coast. And I just wanted to bring up those few points and say thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Aaron.
Aaron Doherty, Down East Initiative, and I just want to echo Tom's comments as well. We also definitely support that, and I would just reiterate that as long as the sector is governed by a hard tack, I think you should be able to allow anyone with a limited access permit into it, whether they have a couple sea days or a limited access hand gear A permit or something like that. And we're probably talking about a very small segment of the fishery where the benefits would be really helpful for those fishermen, but it would be I don't think it would cause any adverse impact for either the stocks or other fishermen. So for that reason, I think this would be a good idea. Thanks.
Okay, back to Eric Anderson, and then back to the council.
Yeah, I was just in looking this and trying to think about all the scenarios that develop. The Potty Charter Boat community has limited access privileges. And if they were to form, then you'd still have to make some type of allocation decision. And without any malice to the, you know, to that event, they still have to work off of information that's relatively, you know, that would have to work off of MRF's data and the reliability of that. I'm just curious, you know, these things can develop. You're allowing them to develop. But after you start to let them develop, they're going to be looking for allocation, and they're going to be looking for allocation based off different history data collection base. So it's just a question to think about, and I don't know where that would go. I just know that there's been a lot of, you know, I do want to get to the fact that you know, there is a lot of controversy with regards to, as you're building this program and you're building history, you know, you're building history in it. I'm very worried with the fact that the information that's coming in now with people that are preparing for this event and have gone out and acquired the history, there's just a tremendous amount of controversy about this. It still somebody has to address this issue somewhere along in this discussion. The controversy of the people that have gone out, had their history information given to them, it's incredible. I mean, you're talking about hundreds of thousands of pounds of fish that people have got history, that they're receiving their history on, that they never caught. I've heard one instance is up to 1 million pounds that a person has received. He never caught it. You have to address this question. This is an imperative question to address the validity of the information that's going to be used in the formulation of these sectors. And somebody has to answer it, because other than that, you're going to, you know, your initial step into the allocation process is immediately flawed if you're not dealing with information that has accuracy. I know it's not, well, there you go. Thank you.
Dave Gatham.
Yeah, I have a couple questions here, probably, I guess, for Pat or Doug. Operationally to the service, does it make any difference who's in the sector as long as the sector manager is enforcing the TAC?
Well, it makes a difference in calculating the sector shares. And then even if the sector manager is monitoring the TAC, ultimately we have a responsibility to monitor that TAC, and so we still need some level of comfort that the information we're getting would allow us to do that.
Okay, because what was said a little while ago is that a sector quote unquote, a group of individuals is granted some portion of a TAC. And obviously, we're going to have to determine that on some number of individuals' catch history through what we just spent 8 hours on to form that sector. So it may not be granted to an individual, but it's a sum of those individuals. So it's still granted to individuals. Now, if a bunch of individuals bring zero, you know, they got a C-day permit, they got an open access permit, they got a, I don't know what they got. I can think of a whole bunch of people that got zero. Confirmation of history permit. If a sector wants to let those people in and dilute its already limited amount of fish even more, I guess it should be their prerogative. I mean, I don't see how it changes anything as long as there's accountability. And from where I sit, the sector manager is ultimately accountable to you. And, you know, if enforcement doesn't have concerns about these people wandering around on the water, then I don't see that we should. If enforcement does have concerns about people without a limited access multi-species permit wandering around on the water catching fish, then we ought to state that right up front. Because certainly they don't have much to take away if they violate the rules. You can't take away what they don't have. Whereas with somebody with an A-day permit, whatever it gets called at the end of all this, you still got something that you can rip up, and that's the ultimate penalty. Because then they are out of the set, they're out of everything. So I'm not sure. We're spending a huge amount of time on something that may not be an issue unless, you know, Pat says it's an issue. And that's what I'm trying to get to here.
Frank.
Yeah, thank you. I'm looking at this motion, and I think the intent of the motion is that only limited access vessels can be in a sector. But that's not what the motion says. The motion says that limited access vessels can be joining the sector, but it's silent on vessels that don't have a limited access. So right now, if this motion goes through, all it says is if you have a limited access, you can join the sector. And everybody else can join the sector, too. So if the intent is, you've got to fix the motion if that's the intent. I know it's a committee motion, so it'll take somebody else to do it.
You're not that guy?
Well, I would support it the way it is. I wouldn't support it with the change.
Jim Arthur.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think the wording in H3 covers it. It says a sector means a group of persons holding a limited access vessel permit, a limited access permit, who've decided that they want to voluntarily form a sector. So reading that, if you don't have a limited access permit, multi-species, you can't be in a sector. But I think this is going aside, you may have a limited access permit, but not have an allocation. But you still can be in a sector as long as the other people in the sector want to divvy up their piece of the pie to you. But everybody has to have a limited access permit. I think H3 covers it. I don't know why the motion is different than H3, because I guess we're working off two different places, maybe. So is that the actual wording of the motion we made at the committee?
Yes.
Okay.
I was about to ask for you, Lori. Lori.
The first part of that shaded paragraph is directly out of the council sector policy. It is the council sector policy that specifies that a sector has to be a group of persons holding a limited access vessel permit. All the Groundfish Committee motion does is clarify that that's a limited access multi-species permit. And I read it, and I interpreted it the same way that Jim just described. It limits the language that's in this paragraph as well as the language that is an attempt to clarify it by the committee, limits sector participation to limited access multi-species permit holders.
If you want to correct the problem, you know, to address Frank's reading of this here. I mean, it's very easily fixed. I don't know if you know, you can just say that only vessels with limited access permits may join a sector. Multi-species permits.
Yeah, we've got a disconnect here. We've got a motion from the committee, and then we've got a document in front of us that... Tom?
Okay, let's review the history here. Amendment 13 said sectors could form in groundfish if you had a limited access permit. The sector policies of the regulations that was implemented said that any persons may submit a sector allocation proposal for a group of limited access vessels, multi-species vessels, to form a sector. That's specific. That says that the sector can only be formed with limited access multi-species vessels. A question came up over the course of the summer about whether or not permits without any history, however that turns out to be defined, could join a sector. And then a subsequent question came up with, does this really mean all limited access permits, including the hand gear A category, who quite honestly, I think we forgot about when we developed Amendment 13 and whether they'd apply to sectors. And so the committee passed a motion to make it clear that the only criteria for joining a groundfish sector is that you have a limited access multi-species permit. You don't have to have history. You can have a hand gear A permit. That's what the committee motion was intended to do. It wasn't intended to conflict with either the council policy, which I don't think it conflicts with, and it wasn't intended to conflict with the existing regulations. It was just making it clear, because we had some questions in particular from the service about whether the council really meant that people that didn't have any history could join a sector and that hand gear A permits could join a sector. And the committee discussion was, yes, they can. Let's pass a motion saying if you've got a limited access multi-species permit, you can, in fact, join a sector without, you know, having to bring history to the table or not. I mean, that's all this does. I honestly am having trouble understanding why people think the motion and the language in this document don't match up, because I actually think they match up pretty well. You know, that's all the committee motion was trying to do, was to make it clear that in the committee's mind, you don't have to bring history to the table. And if you have a hand gear A permit, which is a limited access permit, you are potentially eligible to join a sector as well.
Well, in the sector policy, the definition doesn't say that the limited access permit needs to be in the sector, needs to be in the FMP that the sector is being formed under.
It says it has to, no, you're right, I guess it doesn't. It says it has to achieve objectives consistent with applicable FMP goals and objectives.
Jim Audlin.
Well, to try to move this, so I'm going to offer a motion to amend, kind of as a clarifying offer, that only vessels with a limited access multi-species permit can join a groundfish sector. So the only change is change all to only.
Seconded by Terry Stockwell. Do we need to have any more discussion? Pat Kirkle.
Our original question had to do with confirmation of permit histories. I don't know where you all went off, but technically a limited access vessel permit is not the same thing. So we would just ask that in the document that it's clear that it includes confirmation of permit histories.
Yeah, just to make it clear so I know the clarification. You know, I think one issue that Pat's comment raises is whether or not the permit has to come out of CPH and be put on a vessel before it can join a sector, or whether it can still sit in CPH and be on a sector, or whether that activity is somehow prohibited, that they can't take it out of CPH, put it on a vessel, and now put it in a sector. Now, I don't know that we're going to clarify that now, but I think the committee needs to pin down which versions of those we're trying to allow.
Any more discussion on the motion to amend? I don't know. I don't really know anymore. It's up there. Let's just do it.
Can I ask?
Frank.
I want to ask Tom, will this do in what Maggie asked you earlier?
Well, actually, I think, and maybe I can't tell if she's shaking her head up and down, I think this motion actually precludes what she was trying to do earlier. Perhaps. Once again, if she tells us.
But I read the previous motion to exclude them also, so I don't think there's much difference there. I think if you want to include the monkfish under an umbrella, then that's going to have to be something added, I believe. Either one of those won't fix that problem. So I think we ought to deal with the first fix first, and if we do want to deal with the other fix, it has to be something separate.
Dave Gatham.
All right, back to the confirmation of permit history. Do we have to say that in here? Is that apparently a separate name for a permit? Does it have to specifically go in there? I need an answer for that, I guess.
I just wanted to address somewhere at some time. If you know the answer, I mean, I think Tom is exactly right. You need to decide whether or not the CPH needs to be moved to a vessel or not. And if you're saying it doesn't have to be, it can just be a confirmation of permit history, and that can be brought to a sector, then yes, you should definitely clarify it here. If that's not something that the committee has decided yet, then I just ask that it be clarified at some point.
And just to that point, I mean, to make it easier for everybody, even you guys, I think it's no big deal to take a confirmation permit history, activate it. And by activating it, you put it on something, and then it joins the sector. Otherwise, I think it makes it much more difficult to administer. So if we just be silent on it, I think the problem it takes care of itself, that they have to activate the CPH before they can use it in any way, shape, or form. So if we stay silent, I think we make it life easier on all of us, including the service.
That would make it consistent with leasing. But it's not consistent with what Tom's understanding of what the committee had decided was. So did I misunderstand?
No, I don't think I said, but I mean, having read this language that says all vessels with a limited access permit, it's got to be on a vessel, which means if you want to put it on a vessel, then you can put it in a sector. It means it can't sit unattached to a vessel in the CPH category and contribute to the sector.
Okay. Ready for the question? All those in favor, please raise your hand. Twelve. Opposed? Two opposed. That was a motion to amend, so now we're on the main motion as amended. Any further discussion? Ready for the question? All those in favor, please raise your hand. Two opposed. Motion as amended carries. How much farther and deeper do you want to go tonight? There's probably 25 or 30 more motions. Jim Odlin.
In deciding that, big question, I mean, don't we, if we don't go all the way, then where do we, what do we do in February? That's my question. So it's just out there.
Tom Nace.
There's a couple things that I think might help this discussion a little bit. The first is that before you decide whether to go through this list of motions, I think you need to ask yourself, are there any other big, broad, overarching topics with regard to this sector idea that you want to talk about? I'm not asking leading questions, but this morning there was the suggestion that some people felt there were big, broad, overarching questions, and I don't believe we've talked about all of them yet. And, you know, I think in some respects it may be better to talk about those today rather than some of these issues. Because ultimately, of course, when it comes to February, rather than go through these individually, you could always look at the document and say, yeah, okay, that all makes sense. We'll go forward. The other thing is that I think in actuality there's a couple points that are in here that even if you don't decide to go through all the motions, I think, you know, between the chair and I, with a couple minutes, we could probably identify ones that may or may not be controversial to people that we ought to highlight that are changes that, you know, if we're going to talk about anything tonight, we should make sure we talk about these particular issues.
Well, I'm intrigued by that possibility that you and the chair could spend a few minutes and populate a list and rank it up. Dr. Pierce?
Well, I don't want to go to midnight, I'll say that. I was guided by the agenda when I came here this morning. I assumed, because of the way the agenda was worded, that we would deal with the allocation alternatives and then we would get into the rest of the issues, and there are many of them, but we would look specifically at what I consider to be overarching and critical issues, the catch monitoring requirements, and then the common exemptions for all sectors, et cetera, et cetera. So those seemed to, they jumped out at me, and that got me, you know, keyed up and prepared to really discuss those particular points. And also they addressed very specifically some extremely important elements of the letter that Pat sent all of us as to what needs to be done as far as she's concerned to make sectors efficient, simple, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't mind spending a bit more time on those elements, but let's agree when we're going to stop. Otherwise, you know, we'll just keep going and going and going without supper, and it'll lead to very sloppy discussions.
Sage advice. It's 6 o'clock now. We say 7:30 maximum. Is that too long for people? Or do you want to just keep churning? I mean, Dr. Pierce can leave if he wants to. And we know which things he wants to talk about, so we can wait till he leaves, and then we can talk about those. Not that that ever happens here, but... 7:30 sound like a legitimate target, or do people want to just keep going? And Jim?
Well, it just comes back to my question. You know, I don't know if it's 7:30 or 7:45 or 7:55. The question to me is, if we don't get through this, then where do we end up? And if it's nowhere, then I'm going to say, I want to get through it. You know, that's what I'm going to say. But if it's, well, we get through part of it, and they can continue to develop a document that we can look at and finish up on in February, then you can pick a time and say, we'll do as much as we can. We'll get the points that they need to get taken care of that will let them get a document. Then that changes. So that's the question to me is, where do we end up if we just deal with the points that Tom and Rip come up with that we need to deal with so that they can develop a document? And we should take the time to do that. So we have a document in February to continue moving forward with Amendment 16 in general.
Tom Nace.
Well, I'd like to reflect back on the committee chair's introduction this morning. I mean, the goal today was twofold. The first was to try and refine or define, however you want to put it, the alternatives for potential sector contributions. That was one goal. And the other goal was to educate the council on the decisions that the committee has made. I think we've met the first goal at considerable pain, but we did. So we met that. So now the point is what, you know, I think the thing to look at is, okay, we need to educate the council on the committee deliberations. And I think I would at this hour say we need to educate you on what we think are the most critical ones. We need to remember that in February we're not voting on a final document. In February what we're planning to do is say, okay, these are the alternatives that we want to develop into a final document. We're not voting. You're not going to see analysis of everything. You're not going to see measures text for everything. You're going to see some, you know, kind of a skeleton of what the alternatives are that we're going to develop. So, you know, you'll have at least some opportunity in February if you notice things that we don't talk about today to continue to ask questions and to refine those. And quite honestly, I think we've got about a day and a half scheduled for the groundfish discussion in February, which, you know, maybe it isn't going to turn out to be long enough, but, you know, what we're trying to debate here is which alternatives are going into the document, not which one are we going to finally choose. So you just want to make sure they cover the range of what you might want to choose later on down the road. But, I mean, I like I said, I think the chair and I can identify some key issues that I think we ought to highlight that are issues with the development of sectors. And I don't know, maybe the regional office has some that they want to identify as well that are worth highlighting here.
All right, why don't we take 10 minutes, and hopefully if the regional office wants to confer with Tom and Rip. With myself on the original intent of this meeting and also talk to staff and the chair of the committee, and the intent of this meeting was to get over the hurdle on the allocation discussion and then to start going through some of the other issues that are outstanding. We're not going to get through all of the sector questions that exist, okay? It's not possible. Rodney doesn't think he'll live long enough. I happen to think you will, Rodney, but we've identified at least one issue that the council needs to get educated on in terms of what has and has not been done thus far at the committee level, and we're hoping for some input from the council, and that's the issue of monitoring. So I don't know if Tom wants to lead off or if Rip wants to lead off on the monitoring discussion, but that's where we're going to start this discussion, and I would recommend that we go no longer than 8 o'clock. It's 6:30 now. Unless there's objection. So Rip or Tom, either one of you can pick up and describe the progress thus far in monitoring.
I'll quickly just indicate that people should turn to the document number 2. It's section under monitoring. It's on page. It begins on page 7, and that's what we will be discussing. And then, Tom, you can take over from there.
I'm going to summarize the whole section and walk through it. The committee may decide to take up the issues separately, but I think it'll be easier if I just go through it all at once. I think there's been a recognition by a lot of people, including in the industry, the PDT, and at the committee, that if you're going to monitor, if you're going to rely on tax as your conservation control of the sectors, and we are, that it's important to actually know what the catch is. And so there's been considerable discussion and thought put in on the catch monitoring system. Now, I'm going to try and be clear. When I say catch, I mean both landings and discards. If I use landings or discards, I mean landings or discards. But I'd like to point out before I get going that, you know, there's considerable work that's going on outside the council process with respect to trying to get a handle on this catch monitoring problem, primarily for sectors, but some of the lessons may be applicable to the rest of the fishery as well. GMRI, for example, is in the process of letting a contract, or they may have already let a contract, to have some experts take a close look at our monitoring system and prepare a report on what would be needed or how it could be improved to monitor sectors. And we're hopeful that that information may be brought forward to the council in time, that it can influence some of the later decisions that are made on this amendment. We also know, of course, that the regional office has been working on these issues internally. The PDT has spent a little bit of time and made some recommendations, but, you know, quite honestly, the PDT is not convinced they have the expertise to develop a monitoring system. So I'm going to go through a couple points here. I'm really going to focus on H4, well, the two H4s, monitoring enforcement of landings and monitoring enforcement of discards, and try and highlight some of the things that the committee has suggested. The first is that we're asking and requiring in the operations plans that there be a little more detail about how landings will be monitored, and in addition, how discards will be monitored and reported and enforced. When it comes to landings, the key point is that sectors will be required to land all legal-sized fish from stocks managed by the FMP that are specifically allocated to the sector. This language might sound a little odd, but we haven't talked about the fact that the Groundfish Committee is recommending that 4 stocks not be allocated to the sector for a variety of reasons. The intent is that those 4 stocks, mortality on them would be controlled by restrictive limits so they're not targeted. An example of one is Atlantic halibut, where the intent is the sector would still be limited to 1 halibut per trip. So we can't really require a sector to land all fish from the FMP. It's the ones where they get a specific allocation. The committee has said that sectors must demonstrate the ability to accurately attribute landings to a specific statistical area. This is because, of course, the tax are stock-specific, and the stocks are determined by statistical area. This is left somewhat vague with the intent of not trying to micromanage the sector's operations. They could, for example, meet this requirement by saying on any given trip you'll only fish in, you know, 1 stock area or 1 statistical area. But there may be other ways they could do it, perhaps by demonstrating through VMS or whatever that they know where the vessel has actually fished and when it landed on those trips. Sectors required to report all landings and discards to NIMS on a weekly basis. I think this may be a carryover from existing regs. I know the sectors report landings anyway on a weekly basis. The next big one is sectors are required to develop and implement an independent third-party waymaster system that is satisfactory to NIMS for monitoring landings and utilization of ACE. The details of the waymaster system must be provided in the sector operations plan. This is so that sectors, all the sector landings are monitored by a waymaster and verified by a waymaster that is not someone under the direct employ of the sector, and the waymaster program meets standards established by the service. Now, when it comes to monitoring and enforcement of discards, this, of course, it becomes an issue. As you note, up above, sectors are required to land all legal-sized fish, so if we can verify that they can land all legal-sized fish, that's a good thing. But there's a possibility that they may not land all legal-sized fish, so we have to know discards. We make it clear, and this is something that's directly from the council sector policy, discards will not be counted when determining the sector's ACE, but will be counted against the ACE. What this means is we don't factor in discards when determining sector share because we don't know each individual permit's discards. The next point is that discards will be counted at a previous assumed discard rate calculated as often as practicable. You can read the rest of this section, unless a sector can develop an adequate monitoring system. What this means is that if you have a sector that has a specific gear, that when they're given their ACE, their annual catch entitlement, what they're allowed to catch, that using information will determine that, you know, normally they discard, let's say, 15% of what they catch, and so we'll take 15% off the top, and their landings are limited to that 15%. Now, if the sector is not willing to live with that 15%, they have to come up with a system to demonstrate that their discards are something different than that. And they have to demonstrate to NIMS that they can prove that, and then they can use perhaps some discard rate that is not based on that assumed discard rate. And once again, we just reiterate here, they have to report all landings and discards to NIMS on a weekly basis. Now, this last line in italics, transparency, you know, trying to make it clear that this section is in italics because it was originally suggested by the PDT, but it has not actually been adopted by the committee. We just put it here for informational purposes. I don't know if the committee is going to decide to act on that later or not, but that has not currently been adopted by the committee. That's where we are. And I suspect that will lead to some questions from some council members.
Dr. Pierce, I know you're well prepared to deliberate on this.
Well, I was actually prepared to make a motion, a little long, but I guess my question first would be, this is monitoring and enforcement of landings and discards, a process, a procedure, a concept that's evolving, correct? And that we're not yet in a position to say that we know what it's going to be, that we have concluded the best possible way to go. I get that take from Tom. As a consequence of that, because this is not really the done deal, I'm going to hold off on making a motion. I'd rather raise these issues at the committee level. However, there's one thing I would like to point out, and that is that I am uncomfortable with the language in H4 as it stands right now, because it's too, it could be too easy. It could be, it might not provide enough motivation for a sector to actually do the hard job of developing an adequate monitoring system that would enable us to determine what's being discarded. And I say that because if the assumed discard rate is too low, you know, in quotes, too low, that might be acceptable to a sector. They might be willing to accept that discard rate as a way of not having to go through the hassle of having an observer program that would possibly entail there being significant coverage, maybe 50% or more of all the trips in a sector. I'm thinking that way, by the way, at least 50%. There has to be real motivation for the sectors to put in place that observer program, because I and others like me, and I can reference some discussions that have been held at the GMRI relative to providing motivation for an observer program. There has to be a reason why the sector will implement that program. So I'm more inclined to, I'm not going to make a motion now, but I just want people to know how I'm feeling. I'm more inclined to say that we should start off, and this is consistent also with what Pat said in her letter to the council about, let's go with an assumed discard rate. I would never go with that concept unless that assumed discard rate was very high, and then the sectors would have to prove that it's not as high through that observer coverage or whatever, electronic means, whatever is there, to convince us that indeed the assumed discard rate could be lowered. If I can't be convinced that there is an effective observer program that will enable us to determine with a high degree of confidence what actually is caught and then discarded, then I'm not going to be in a position to be as supportive of sectors as I am right now, because we're allocating. People get privileges. They're in or they're out. And those who are out need to be assured that those who are in are actually recording accurately that which is caught and that which is discarded. If we don't do that, then it's a travesty to those who are on the out. This is the big decision we're making, that is, you know, allocations, perhaps eventually leading to ITQs. So is my principal concern about this particular H4, and I'm assuming that, again, as this evolves, we'll have more discussion about ways to make sure we have that motivation to have all the sectors implement an observer program, either as individual sectors or collectively, putting their combined resources together to come up with some sector observer program to give us what we need relative to Are they keeping to the TACs? And also, of course, relative to what we need to help us make our assessments better than what they are right now, because without good catch information, the assessments will be a mess. There'll be high uncertainty, and then we'll have the situation where we will be obliged through ACLs and through what we discussed at the committee level at our last meeting, we'll be obliged to adopt TACs that are far lower than what they otherwise should be, in the interest of being very cautionary in our approach. All right, so without that's off my chest, and I'll be revisiting this issue, with the committee when it comes up again. And I hope that Pat as well, that the National Marine Fisheries Service puts more thought into this, maybe enhances or embellishes that particular suggestion that you made about the assumed discard rate. It can't be an average discard rate. It's got to be a very high assumed discard rate, exclusive of that observer program, in order to make sure that the sectors have that motivation to put in place an observer program.
Is your motion longer than that, or it's late?
It is. Then I'll move. No, okay.
I can say that. It's late, Dave. On monitoring, further discussion or questions or direction for the committee, Jim Odwin.
A little bit is that it's my reading that a lot of the discards that we have at present are regulatory discards because of arcane trip limits or whatever, and that they're going to be high enough as it is because of the regulatory discards that we've required on the fleet for a long period of time. And part of the attraction of sectors to me is that we are able to lift these trip limits, thereby minimizing discards. So that the idea came out that, well, we don't have a number, so we'll use the assumed rate of today, which is too high. The discards are too high. But there's a reason they're too high. So if this is successful and we lift the trip limits, and I think it's been the experience of the previous sectors that their discard rate will come down. And what we built into this is that because it's going to be an artificially high discard rate because of the regulatory discards that will be lifting that requirement, that we built in this that it's up to the sector to come forward and adjust that assumed discard rate. Now, Dave was making a kind of a thing that maybe somebody, the discard rate would be so low they wouldn't do that, but I can't find a place where that would actually work. They will come forward, and they will come forward very fast to try to adjust that discard rate in order to not be charged it and turn that into money. So I just the opposite thinking about it is that I think that once we use this initial assumed discard rate, it's much, much too high. And that's because of all the trip limits we've had, in spite of the fact that we're not catching the target TACs and we're discarding way more fish than we should be. So that's my feeling about that we tried to build in an incentive for the industry or the sector to rapidly turn that discard rate into money. And that's what this is about. When they have an incentive to turn something into money, they'll figure out a way to get that adjusted.
Dave, to that point?
Yeah, to that point, I agree. However, we're going into new territory. We're going into the territory involving hard TACs and probably very small hard TACs for some sectors where it's going to be awful difficult for them to live with small TACs for some stocks that they fish that will impact their ability to fish on the other TACs that they get for their sector, the higher TACs. I'm concerned about the limiting TAC and what that might do to membership behavior. Again, human beings are human beings, and I've said before, desperate people do desperate things, and there has to be observers to see what's happening. So we're assured that, indeed, the sector is playing by the rules. Therefore, there has to be some motivation, some incentive to get them to do what's necessary, to have that observer system put in place and not after they give a lot of thought to it, conclude, we'll just accept those assumed discard rates and let it fly. I'm still distrustful. And, again, we're going into a new world. Well, not a new world. We're returning to the world of the late 1970s. And I don't want to go through those problems again and end up with, the unaccounted for catch, the wonderment of it all. What's happening today? As I sit in my office in Boston with my telescope looking at Boston Harbor, but unfortunately I can't see George's Bank, I don't want to be left in that position where I'm just wondering what's happening with absolutely no confidence that I do understand what's happening. And then the assessments come and we challenge the assessments because of the information we suspect is not good, but we don't know how bad it is. And I need confidence that this is going to work, that we'll have catch in hand. And once that happens, then I'll embrace sectors to the max.
We have other hands up. Jim, I have a question, and maybe it's the question you're going to answer, but is the Science Center capable of assigning assumed discard rates to each gear and each area for each species?
Well, I don't know the answer to that, really. I'm sure that we're put in the position lots of times of having little information but having to come up with a number, so this would be another example of that. But for some species, we might be able to do it fairly well.
Rodney?
Yeah, I agree with Jim Hodlin that it's a lot of the discards are regulatory, and then a lot of the discards that are observed with observers are extrapolated, so that just carries that a little further. But Dr. Pierce reminds me of the little old lady who buys a brand new car and won't go drive it because she's going to get a flat tire. So
that's two for Dave. Rip.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, to the same point, I think the committee had extensive discussions on this. One of the points is that the discards are counted against the TAC of the sector. And if the sector can take some of that assumed discard and by coming up with analysis that shows that it's lower, they automatically turn that into money rather than something that's just counted against their TAC. So there is certainly a very strong reason for them to go ahead with that analysis. Dr. Pierce was indicating that he was going to bring his concerns up to the committee on this. The committee has already determined and passed a motion to bring to the council, and I'm not exactly sure when we as a committee will get back to the opportunity to discuss that beyond what we already have.
I recall that some discard information is included in assessments. Might there be an opportunity that the assessment will not include discards, yet the management measures would include discards, and what does that do? In other words, must we only apply a discard, assumption, only if the assessment contains discard assumptions?
Yeah, I think in most cases, discard estimates are used in our stock assessments. I have a question, if I could pose it. I don't, and this might be for Tom. I'm not sure. It sounds like there could be a lot of additional need for observers. And I was wondering if the committee has had discussions with the Science Center about the magnitude of the increase in the number of observers that might be needed if X number of sectors were put in place and when that would be needed.
Of course not. I mean, it's late, but no. First off, the
I don't know if Amy is still here. The Amy Van Atten from the Observer program has been following these discussions very closely. She's been coming to most, if not all, our Groundfish Committee meetings, and she and I do talk on occasion about this stuff. So the Observer program, at least, is aware of the ongoing sector development. One of the things that we're not certain about, quite honestly, is logically, vessels fishing in sectors should be more efficient than those fishing under effort controls. And so it's actually entirely possible that if you go to sectors, you're going to have fewer days fishing. And so, you know, if you have a level of observer coverage based on number of observer days that you have out there, it's difficult at this point to say whether or not we're going to have enough observer days for the sectors or not. I think there's another related issue, and that is the fact that our observer program is not currently designed, the observer coverage is not designed to make sure you sprinkle observers at a certain level on every sector. You know, that's not the way the program is designed to operate. And so we don't know if the observer coverage we're going to get is going to provide the types of information that you need for each sector. Now, the Groundfish PDT at one point was suggesting that perhaps it would be appropriate to establish some sort of standard that had to be met by every sector, similar to the lines of the SBRM, where we say we're trying to achieve a certain standard, and that if the sector didn't have that level of coverage, they had it to provide it. But the committee didn't act on that particular suggestion. Just to comment on two points, you know, the PDT has pointed out that, you know, one of the problems with this assumed discard rate is the one that I think Mr. Odlin raised, and that is the first year to go to sectors, you're not going to have any discard rates based on sector operations. So the only assumed discard rates you're going to have are ones generated under a regime with regulatory discards. And another problem is that even going forward, there's no guarantee that your observer coverage will be distributed in such a way that you can generate a sector-specific discard rate in a given fishery. So, you know, your discard rate may be a blend of what's going on in sectors and what's going on out in the common pool with the assumed discard rates. I think I answered Jim's question.
I guess from my perspective, that's that second point that you made, Tom, is could be problematic, and the concept that you would just blend discard rates based on coverage across multiple sectors. If you go on page 8, monitoring and enforcement of discards, H4, the second bullet, talks about taking an assumed discard rate off the ACE, and then unless a sector can develop an adequate monitoring system and demonstrate to NIMS that discards can be accurately monitored, so on and so forth. That kind of reminds me of the provision we put into a document that said that if the RA wants to, she can approve new gears out in eastern U.S. Canada SAP. But we never defined what the criteria were for her to evaluate whether new gears should be approved, and we ended up going through two or three attempts at that through two or three different actions. So I know there's external groups that are working on trying to arrive at what might be considered an adequate monitoring system so that a sector could alleviate itself or prove that the assumed discard rates aren't the true discard rates in a sector. But I think that's a place within this discussion that we need to more fully develop, and it may be that we wait for this report to come out, or the first draft of this report to come out, I guess, in April or the end of March. But I think this is all well thought out, but the actual mechanics of how a sector alleviates itself from an assumed rate needs to be part of the amendment in order for people to feel comfortable. Pat.
Thank you. Folks have covered a lot of the things that I was going to speak to. You know, we suggested that there be an assumed discard rate, in part because we think it's the only game in town right now. Until there is an alternative, the point really is somehow discounts have discards have to be taken into consideration, and not just because we're going to sectors, but also because we're going to ACLs AMs. Thank you. I think that the monitoring part of this is probably the most critical piece of it. Yes, it's an input control, and we need to have a better handle as a result of it being an input control on catch, output control, sorry. Paul on my shoulder. What should I say next, Paul? Oh. Sorry. It is getting late, sorry. it's also that we need to have a handle because of the complexity of the system, and because if we do end up someday where in a situation where sectors are the primary component of the fishery, that most of the industry is involved in some sector or another, then we need to be very comfortable that we know what's happening within those sectors and they're operating as they should. So as I said, I think monitoring is probably one of the most critical parts of it, if not the most critical part of it. Now, we had suggested, well, maybe let me just deal with the discard part of it first. I think Jim and Rip both did a good job of articulating sort of our thinking on this. I think when people start to see what discards are costing them, that it does in fact provide an incentive to reduce those discards and to turn those discards into landings. I don't think that this falls all on the center. Obviously, they would be involved, as we all would, in estimating assumed discard rates. But again, this is something we're going to have to figure out for ACLs anyway. And it's not work on top of what we already need to be doing. We had suggested in our letter that, in fact, one way to simplify the monitoring, one way to work within the existing constraints that we have in our monitoring program, is to confine each sector to one area, which is what we have for the two sectors we have now. And the committee did not adopt that recommendation, and we're concerned about that. Frankly, what we were telling you is what we think we can do with what we have. So if you go beyond that, then we don't have any comfort level that we have the infrastructure to monitor a program that allows sectors to operate in multiple areas. I know I've heard the argument that what we're going to do is put the burden on the sectors, and that's largely what this language does, except we've still got common pool vessels, and so we still need some system for monitoring the common pool vessels. We need an approach for dealing with whether or not we'll have duplicate monitoring systems, or will the sector monitoring systems somehow replace the existing monitoring systems. I was really glad that John and I think Tom brought up the issue of standards. It's not just the bullet that John pointed out here. There's a couple of the bullets under H4 in the above section, monitoring enforcement of landings, says things like sectors must demonstrate the ability to accurately attribute landings to a specific statistical area. And then the last one, they're required to develop and implement an independent third-party waymaster system. Well, what are the standards for those? Who's going to judge whether or not the sector met those requirements? And how are we going to and what's the fallback if they didn't? Does that mean that the sector is completely rejected for the year? I think there's still a lot of work that needs to be done on sectors. I know there are some independent groups working on it. I would just urge the council again to think about what we can and can't do, and making sure that at least for this first go-around, we make decisions that would allow us to be successful and not set ourselves up to fail. And so I would certainly encourage you to at least include an alternative in the document that would restrict sectors to one area.
Dave Gable.
Thank you. Still trying to get the image of Dave and his telescope out of my mind. My father worked in Boston in the 1970s. They had a telescope on his floor, and I can assure you they weren't looking at Boston Harbor. Be that as it may, they weren't biologists either, though. The observer data already breaks down discards by legal and sublegal fish. They have two different codes for them. They weigh them up separately. So I think there's certain things we can assume here. One is that the sublegal discard rate probably won't change much, other than how it fluctuates every year as new year classes enter the fishery or don't enter it. And the legal discards, has already been stated, should go to zero, assuming we make a few changes in some of this wording, which is the next thing I was going to bring up. One thing, it says all legal-sized fish, but it doesn't address the issue of whether they're saleable legal fish. I mean, so do we have, gillnet is bringing in things that the slime eels have tunneled through. That's a legal-sized fish. There's nothing in it, but it's a legal-sized fish. Do we have the draggers bringing in things that, I caught a fish the other day, a pollock, and a seal bit the stomach out of it. It was still alive, but it wasn't saleable. I mean, I think we ought to make some kind of we don't want people bringing in a bunch of junk that they got to turn around and throw back off the dock. So I think it should be legal saleable fish, for one thing. The second is the issue of transfer at sea. I think we need to repeal that. Otherwise, you're going to have situations develop where people can't bring in all their legal size fish. They won't fit in their boat. You get a big toe or something, or you got, the pollock slam your net. You just won't fit them all in there. So I think we should repeal that as part of the sector. The sector shouldn't have to operate under the transfer at sea provisions. If I get 20,000 and I got a neighbor out there and I can only hold 10, here, you take 10, I'll take 10, the fish still get counted for. I mean, other than that, I'm just going to bring them up to the back of the boat, wait for the net to explode, and have a bunch of them mysteriously go away. I have no choice. Boat doesn't hold 20,000. It'll sink. So, again, we've got to be careful what we say in the language here. What else did I have circled here? Oh, this issue of waymasters. Now, I've observed the waymaster system in Atlantic Canada, and I've observed it in Scotland. And I don't have much faith in a waymaster system of any kind. I don't care what kind of language we provide. I don't care. I haven't seen it done in a way that it accounts for fish if people don't want them accounted for. I watched in Canada, in Scotland, where boats come in, they take the waymaster to the pub. A bunch of fish go into trucks and vanish down the road. The guy comes back from the pub. Here we are. We're ready to unload. As an example, I just don't see how we can design a system that's going to be any different than other countries that have already tried this system. I think it's an inherently flawed system. I think the onus has to be on the individual boat that, he brings the fish in, and on the dealer, that the fish go to the dealer. Same thing we have now. You can't sell it to an unlicensed dealer. If you do, that's a violation. We have an assortment of enforcement regulations in place already that do the best they can to account for fish being landed. And I don't see any reason why we need anything any greater than that. So those are just some of my thoughts on the wording here as it exists at the moment. To this issue that David has a 50% observer coverage, maybe the first year you need that. That sounds like an awful high number to me, but maybe you do. And my second question would be, who is going to pay for all this stuff? Where's the money going to come from? We've got to pay for the sectors. We've got to pay for the observers. We've got to pay for the waymasters, potentially. On what? Virtually no fish that we're going to be allowed to land. I see the cost here starting to exceed the value of the fish you can land already, and we're just tipping the iceberg. I begin to wonder about the viability of this whole thing if we're going to put all these constraints on it. Now, if a bunch of outside groups are going to come in, you know, the people that are always calling for more observers, and they're going to toss $5 or $6 million into this to pay for them, great. I can put one on my boat every day. I could care less. But if it's going to cost me $1,200 to go out and catch $800 worth of fish, which is about the going rate for an observer now, as I understand it, and $800 is about what I catch every day. No. It's a non-viable situation. It's dead on arrival. So, you know, we really better have a little more discussion about this.
Anyone else? Tom?
With your permission, I'd like to ask a question on one of NIMS's recommendations. And this relates to the one with respect to sectors being restricted to one area. In reality, the two sectors we have now are not restricted to one stock area. They're restricted to the Georges Bank cod stock area, but that covers the Georges Bank yellowtail, Cape Cod Gulf of Maine yellowtail, Southern New England yellowtail stock areas. It covers the Georges Bank winter flounder and the Southern New England Mid-Atlantic winter flounder stock area. Now, those particular sectors did not ask for allocations of that in the past, but they will presumably get, depending on the sector allocation thing that's developed, presumably get allocations of those stocks, maybe very tiny ones, but they'll get them. So the question I have is, when you say sectors are restricted to operating in one area, do you mean, you know, one broad area like the Gulf of Maine, Georges Bank, Southern New England, or do you mean one stock area?
You want to pile on to that, Jim?
While preparing to answer that, I just want to make it clear whether it's restricted to one area during a trip. It's not just saying you can't ever fish in out of that area.
I guess I thought you had our recommendation, our specific recommendation, but it's basically four areas, and they're based on stock areas, but they're fairly broad areas, like Gulf of Maine is one. Gulf of Maine, Southern New England, and an inshore Georges Bank and an offshore Georges Bank. And that would be on the recommendation is not on a trip, but on a the sector itself.
It could be on a trip.
Okay. Trip or sector itself. Either one.
That's the part that I'm confused about, because if you, as I just imagine it, if you say sector A can only fish in, they choose Gulf of Maine, that means they can never go out of that area. That sector operation can't operate out of that area is very different than saying, well, you can on a per-trip basis, but otherwise you'll have people, sectors take on a tremendously different shape than what's been assumed so far. So I assumed it was all on a per-trip basis, but have my doubts, and now I'm really concerned. So.
No, I think you're right. I mean, the goal is to be able to attribute the landings to a stock area. And so as long as we did have the information on a per-trip basis, then you know, that would work.
Tom?
Yeah, and just one follow-up point. This relates to what Mr. Gaethel was saying. There's been a lot of discussion, I think, when we talk about monitoring catch, about whether the observer costs will be the same. You know, The Observer program is basically a scientific data collection program. It has certain standards for the observers. If you're talking about a system that's monitoring to make sure there is not legal-sized discards, your program may look considerably different, both in the training and in the level of qualification and the types of things that these people do, or whether you can do it electronically through video monitoring in some instances. So, you know, I hesitate to think, I mean, don't feel locked in that, you know, the type of observations needed to make sure we know what the sectors are catching is the same type of program we need for our observer program under NIMS, and the costs may be different as well. Just as an example, you know, there's been some work done that suggests that at least in some fleets, it may be possible to use video monitoring to tell whether people are discarding legal-sized groundfish. You know, that's just an example. You may not need a live body on every boat. You know, you may need a camera or a series of cameras on every boat. So, you know, there's a lot of work that's been done in various places around the world that people have been taking a look at to see, okay, you know, what are the other options to try and get these costs down to a manageable level? But this, the cost issue is one that, you know, this is why even, let me just give you an example. Well, it's not a good example because we're not going to allocate ocean pout. But, you know, there are some groundfish species that at times of the year anyway don't have much market and don't have much value to them. And if you're talking $1,200 a day for an observer, you know, maybe the costs aren't going to be low enough that you're going to want to develop a program to show that you're not discarding 10%, you're discarding 5%. You know, the costs may counteract that.
Jim Alden.
Yeah, I understand the services wanting to restrict a vessel on a given trip to one fishing area, but I can tell you that that backfires on you and that it has backfired us until we've finally got some flexibility in that. You can go to an area thinking you're going to be targeting haddock, and you get there, it's 200 miles away, and there's no haddock here this week. There's just codfish, or there's just yellowtail flounder, and there's a few other incidental catches. And by not allowing that vessel the ability to leave that area, you are building in an incentive that if they don't have an observer, they have to stay there and discard, because financially, you've got them in a box. You've got them in a box where their only choice is either to go home and go broke or stay there and try to salvage something out of it. You're not allowing them to leave. And these fish fish can be here this week, gone next week, and then they show up again the following week. It happens all the time. So if you go that way, I think you've almost killed the program to any of the vessels that traditionally fish in more than one area. And that would be mid-size and larger boats. They will not enter into a sector. Now, I think there's other options. One of them is video monitoring or some other type of system that you don't need to know exactly what's happening on that boat. All you need to know is if they're fishing in that area and what they're landing. You know, you can see, and if they go in there for a day and leave, then you ought to be able to attribute the landings to that area. I mean, it's what we've been doing up till now. Because other than that, I think, you know, I concur a little bit with what Dave Gaithel was saying, is that we're approaching the level of cost in a system like this that it's going to fall down on itself. So, and I know that people can't steam to Eastern Georgia's now and think they may or may not be able to get their costs back. I mean, it's just phenomenal how much it costs to go fishing. So I think you may be on the edge. We may need to think a little deeper into that and find a different system. Thank you.
Sally?
Yeah, thanks. I this conversation, I think, has been really helpful, especially for considering what some groups like Gulf of Maine Research Institute are doing as far as trying to make sure that we have a good understanding about what the monitoring and reporting needs are and how to actually implement a system in a timely and cost-effective way so that the burden just doesn't either plunk squarely on the shoulders of an agency that doesn't have the funds to do it or on the industry that has such a small profit margin right now. So I think it would be helpful, rather than just saying what the problems are, because I think we've gone over those pretty thoroughly, it would be helpful, at least for me, to hear now that this discussion has kind of highlighted what some of the concerns are, if we could hear from someone from GMRI to talk about what they are working on now and what they expect to be able to bring to the council in the next couple of months, as far as helping us figure out what the monitoring and reporting needs are, and the you know, what the implementation is going to look like. Also, as far as the cost effectiveness of monitoring and the phase-in, there's been a lot of kind of discussion on the side about funds that are available not directly through National Marine Fisheries Service, but federal appropriations, monies through the state, monies from private sources, including a significant grant that was provided to Environmental Defense, who I work for, and you know, I've talked to a lot of people about how that money can be best spent as far as phasing in a monitoring system that's going to be the foundation for making the sector program work. And you know, I'm committed to making sure that those funds are directed in a way that is going to help actually operationalize a monitoring system that's going to work. So, Mr. Chairman, if we could, I think it would be useful at some point, whenever you might see fit in this discussion, to have some input from GMRI and what they're doing.
I was planning on going to the audience anyway, so nice segue. You've had your hand up, sir, if you want to make a comment on the issue of monitoring landings and discards, and then somebody from GMRI wants to talk about the report, Dan Holland.
Joel Hovenesian, fishing vessel Excalibur Point, Judith, Rhode Island. Restricting movement, Pat, is, I mean, it's killing us now. One of the selling points of it was increased flexibility for the industry. You're basically putting us back into a box again by saying that we're not going to be able to fish in multiple zones and multiple areas. An example of the one that we're dealing with right now, if we were enrolled into the Area 4, Georges Bank Area 4, and I steam out like I have in the past and see haddock on the west side of closed Area 1, which is in the channel, I can't stop and fish on them. I'm forced to go down and fish on the species that you don't want me to fish on. And for the life of me, I could never figure out why we're doing this. We're told that we want to harvest the haddock, yet I'm made to steam over them when I see them, and I can't fish there. And I would have precluded that whole trip. I would have steamed 30 miles instead of 230 miles. And it sounds to me like we're going to try to do more of the same here. I guess what I'm trying to say is you got to take the handcuffs off of us and let us be able to search and hunt and find these things where they're at without being jammed into these boxes. It's a terrible situation, especially now in light of what fuel costs. You know, it makes no sense to have to do this.
Dan Holland?
Hi, Dan Holland, Gulf of Maine Research Institute.
I don't know. I didn't really come prepared to talk about the details necessarily of what these consultants are going to do. And in fact, the details of what they're going to do really are going to be largely up to them. We expect them to be working fairly much independently of us. We're going to be trying to facilitate their communication with the National Marine Fisheries Service, with council staff, and the industry that's involved with sectors. But basically, we put out an RFP just a few weeks ago, actually right before Christmas, asking for to several different consultants, asking for proposals to do a study of the monitoring and reporting needs that are created by sectors, to try and develop some recommendations for standards, and also recommendations for a way to actually implement a monitoring and reporting system that would be satisfactory for monitoring sectors. We've gone ahead and chosen a couple of consultants. The contract is not yet in place, but it will be soon. We'll be contracting with Archipelago Marine and Bruce Turris. Archipelago is a company that has actually some experience here, working already with the Cape Cod Hook guys, but they have quite a bit of experience with running monitoring systems with human observers as well as camera observers. They have the contract right now running the observer program for the British Columbia groundfish fishery, which includes both human observers and camera observers. They also have the contract for running the Waymaster system, dockside monitoring system in that fishery, and have been involved in a number of other fisheries, including several in the U.S. They'll be working with Bruce Turris, who is an independent consultant, but used to work for Department of Fisheries and Oceans and was a key person, was working for DFO as they were developing the groundfish ITQ system out in British Columbia. And he has quite a bit of experience working in other fisheries, including fisheries in the U.S., making recommendations about how to deal with monitoring in an output control system. So those two consultants, Howard McElderry, the president of Archipelago, and Bruce Turris, will be doing this work. We're expecting at this point that they'll come out for an initial visit. We're hoping the week after the February Council meeting, and they would be hoping to hold meetings with the key people at the regional office and Science Center, NIMS people, as well as council staff and industry. And then they would be preparing a report. A phase one report would be standards and recommendations for what the needs are, and a review of what the current system is, and the sort of gaps in the current system as we move to sectors. And then phase two, they would be trying to develop more concrete recommendations about an approach to actually implement a monitoring and reporting system, and they would hope to have that. They should have that report done by June. So I know this is all coming a little bit later than would be ideal. I don't know. We've tried to get them to move up those deadlines as much as we can in order to have it at least provide some information into the council process, and at least these phase one recommendations hopefully can affect what goes into the DSEIS. But that's where we're at with that right now. So can answer any other questions about that.
Any questions for Dan? Thanks, Dan. Anyone else in the audience? Ron?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ron Smallwitz, Fisheries Survival Fund. One of the things I want to point out is to gain at-sea compliance, probably the most important tool is education. If the fishermen learn why a particular measure is in place and there's a consequence for failing to follow that measure, I think you could have a much lower cost monitoring system. And as a farmer, I have a pesticide permit. I have to get 12 continuing education credits every 3 years. The program is run by the universities, but I have to demonstrate every 3 years, send them the state my forms. And there's one enforcement officer in Massachusetts for 6,000 licenses. Just the fear of being caught and the consequence of that is significant enough to make me think twice about doing something wrong. But more importantly, on the flip side, is I understand why I'm doing things. And I've learned in the scallop fishery, for example, when you explain things to people why you're doing something, you gain compliance. The guys that don't comply are the ones that are not involved. The way you get them involved is force them into some system where they have to be exposed to why you're doing things. I think that's a very important tool. We gain very strong compliance with like the 18,000-pound possession limit in the scallop fishery because of the consequence of if you're caught. As long as they know there's some risk of being caught and that they understand the benefit of following a particular system, I think you could cut your monitoring cost. If, in fact, you impose something that's stupid, then, of course, you might not have compliance with that measure if there's no way that you could explain to people the logic behind it. So when you're looking at all these issues relative to monitoring discard, monitoring landings, Dave's right. If the Canadians, if they don't agree, they get around that Waymaster system so simple, it's amazing. But if people believe in why you have a particular possession limit or accountability system, you'll gain compliance and it'll cut your monitoring costs. So I'm just saying I emphasize education as a component of any monitoring system.
Anyone else? Okay, back to the council. Any further questions or discussion points on monitoring? Remember, we're trying to get people familiar with what's been done thus far through the committee on monitoring. That's the main point. Tom?
Yeah, I should have pointed this out at the beginning. I neglected to point out on the addendum down at the bottom, monitoring and enforcement of landings. The addendum follows that document, too. It's document 2A. That the committee voted to require the sectors identify a list of specific ports where the vessels are going to land. I think this was consistent with a recommendation from the service, as I recall.
Yeah. I think 2A was part of the packet that was in front of you today when you came to the meeting, if you're looking for it. Anything else? Anyone want to talk any more about monitoring? If not, go into universal exemptions. Another discussion point that the committee looked over. Tom Neeson.
Ah, yeah. If you look at page 7 of the document 2, right now in Amendment 13, we have a list of a few items. I actually garbled them at the committee meeting, so I'm not going to try and repeat them. But anyway, there's a list of items in Amendment 13 that the sectors are not allowed to get exemptions from. And I referred you to the wrong spot. I meant to refer you to Addendum 2A, sorry. But anyways, Amendment 13 had a list of things that people could not get out of. But one of the suggestions from the service, and so what would happen was each individual sector comes in and they ask for exemptions from specific things. As an example, they might come in and say, well, we want an exemption from trip limits, or we want an exemption from days at sea. And so what the service suggested was rather than have each sector come in and have to ask for a specific exemption from a specific thing and write an EA justifying that, if there are blanket items that we're going to exempt all ground fish sectors from, you know, put those into Amendment 16 and say these are the ones that you're automatically exempt from. And then that analysis will be in Amendment 16, and presumably it'll make it easier for the sectors to do their EA. It also cut down the work on the service trying to review things, and it cuts down the work for the sector figuring out which exemptions they want. So the items that the committee suggested are under the middle bullet there, interaction of section with sector with common pool vessels. Following list of sector exemptions may be modified, but with the implementation of this amendment, all sectors are exempt from trip limits on stocks for which a sector receives an allocation. That's all stocks except the four that are listed. Rolling closures, seasonal closed areas, and days at sea restrictions. And just to be clear, this is groundfish days at sea restrictions. The groundfish plan obviously can't authorize a sector to be exempt from monkfish plan days at sea requirements or scallop plan days at sea requirements. So those were the four universal exemptions recommended by the committee.
Dr. Pierce.
At the committee meeting, I expressed some concern about rolling closures being a exemption that would apply to all sectors. And I expressed that concern in the context of rolling closures, an exemption to rolling closures, perhaps allowing fishing in areas where cod was spawning. And I said it would be very unlikely that any exemption would occur of a rolling closure, if indeed that was happening. As I got deeper into the discussion at the committee meeting, it occurred to me that the existing rolling closures actually might not be protecting spawning codfish, that in light of the changes that have been made over the last few years, we've actually removed months that would have been, that would have afforded protection to codfish when they're spawning. So I asked the committee and specifically Tom through the PDT to look into this a bit more to see if indeed our existing rolling closures were providing protection to spawning codfish, and if they are, then it's likely that that exemption would never be granted by the National Marine Fisheries Service in light of the service's position, justifiable position, regarding opening up closure areas for fishing when groundfish is spawning, in this particular case codfish. Well, I don't need Tom to tell me what he found, because I did a little digging myself. And from what I've been able to find from the work that we did with our own cod industry-based survey, working with fishermen over the last few years, from an examination of a document produced by the Research Steering Committee that describes cod movements from tagging information, and there's also some additional information regarding spawning condition of codfish in certain areas and certain times, it would seem to me that indeed some of the existing rolling closures, not necessarily all of them, but certainly some of them, like May, June, they do afford, well, very likely, they do afford some significant protection to spawning codfish. Therefore, you know, the decision made by the committee relative to there being all sectors being exempt from rolling closures, I suspect will have to be revisited to some extent. An exemption from some rolling closures likely would be justified, maybe the ones in the fall, because during the fall, from the data I've seen, we're not going to find spawning codfish. But the spring rolling closures, May and June, they do afford some rather significant protection to spawning codfish from the data I've looked at. It's pretty convincing. So it's important for us to make a determination, not necessarily today, but certainly sometime very soon, make a determination as to what rolling closures would be exempt. Because I suspect that some of the support, maybe a lot of support for sectors in some communities has come about because of the belief that like the sectors we have on Cape Cod, Orleans, Cape Cod, Hook Association, and the fixed gear sector, where there is an exemption from rolling closures and trip limits. It's likely not going to happen in the Mass Bay, Cape Cod Bay area. It just isn't going to happen. So that needs to be understood from the get-go. And then sectors, of course, can design their strategies accordingly. So just wanted to follow up on that committee discussion and the questions that I asked at the time that I've now answered for myself.
Pat?
Well, that was one question I had, so Dave's answered it for me, too. I appreciate that the committee adopted our suggestion to implement universal exemptions. We think that'll help streamline the process, but I have the same concern about rolling closures and seasonal closures. They were adopted in some cases as spawning closures, and so it doesn't make a lot of sense, I don't think, to allow exemptions for those. I don't think you can reasonably argue that the measures, that the sector provisions will compensate for the seasonal spawning closures. And then the other part of it is when days at sea and target tax are calculated, they're calculated based on an assumption that there is a mortality reduction associated with those closures. So there's going to have to be some compensation if you remove the closures in the form of reduced tax or days. And then the third issue is if you remove those closures or allow exemptions from those closures for the sectors, does it really provide any protection? Do you really get any do you continue to get any benefits from keeping those closures for the common pool vessels? So I think those two in particular are problematic for us.
Anyone else in the council? Dave Gale.
Yeah, I want to concur with both of the previous two speakers. I think that I think we need to re-examine the rolling closures in light of this. We can shift some of the dates around, but I don't think they should go away. I don't think that I think they'd have serious mortality issues. I think that even New Zealand showed you can't run purely an output-based system. They still have input controls. They found they couldn't do it. And I think that, you know, we have to look at the same thing. We're going to need a mix of input and output controls. I think if we don't, I think we could go backwards so fast that by the time we realize we've gone backwards, we couldn't rebuild in 20 years. I mean, you turn those boats loose in Ipswich Bay in May and June, or you turn them loose in Mass Bay at certain times with no trip limit, you know, I shudder to think of what would happen. So I think David's approach is exactly the right way we should go, is look at them. We now have a lot of data on spawning. It's updated. You know, maybe we can lock April off in Ipswich Bay, and maybe we can lock October off in Mass Bay or something. But, you know, to just say wholesale they're going away, I think would be a huge mistake, and it isn't something I'd ever vote for.
We've got Rodney, then Dana Rice, then Terry Stockwell.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have the same concerns. We put those closures in for a reason. Now, to get rid of them, we're just going to flush that down the toilet. Everything we've worked so hard to get this fishery to come back, we're going to just throw away. Look what we did with a SAP a couple of years ago. That was great news. Opening it up, and we just destroyed a fishery out there in a short period of time. So they're there for a reason. They're working. Let them work.
Data?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to echo that sentiment a little bit, I think that a little better the sectors and a little better science could do the dates a little better, but I can't even imagine this council entertaining this conversation to do away with closures. It's insane. I mean, I guess we've got to talk about it, but make them work better, but it'd be nuts to even consider taking them away.
Terry?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Last week I did vote to support the inclusion of roll enclosures into the universal exemptions, but like David, I went back to my office and met with staff, and we've concurred that the roll enclosures are doing their job, at least in the main area, and I'd be prepared to reconsider when we put it back on the table.
Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, Pat made a point that I wanted to respond to regarding I think I've got this right, Pat, that you said the roll enclosures indeed would have some conservation benefit beyond the spawn enclosure protection, and that those are areas where you'd expect to get high catches. Therefore, if the roll enclosures are exempt, you've got to account in some way for the fact that now boats can go into areas where high catches would be expected. The point I want to make is that if we have hard TACs in place, I would think that the hard TACs would account for that. In other words, the days at sea allocations we now have are tuned to some extent with the roll enclosures that we have in place. If we're not going to be managing with days at sea, if we're managing with hard TACs, then we don't have to be as concerned, maybe not concerned at all, about the roll enclosures being used as a mortality reduction tool. It'll be up to the sectors, actually, to make that call themselves as they live with their individual TACs. They're going to have to figure out how to manage the effort within a particular area relative to whether catches are expected to be high or not, whether there'll be discards or not. So I don't think that's really an issue. The issue is, however, as we've already discussed, the spawning condition of the fish, specifically codfish, how they aggregate, how vulnerable they are. We certainly learned that from the research we've done in our cod conservation zone, easily targeted, easily dissipated with a relatively small amount of effort. So I just wanted to make that point, that it'll be all about spawning and the need for the groundfish committee, maybe working with other groups, the research steering committee specifically, I suppose, just refining as best we can, as indicated by David, what months perhaps need no longer be considered as roll enclosures for sector vessels.
Jim Alden.
Yeah, just a brief comment that I agree we may not want to open roll enclosures that are indeed protecting spawning fish, but there's a huge number of these roll enclosures that had nothing to do with spawning. Some were mortality reductions that if we're under an ace or a hard tack, we wouldn't need, and others were just to share the pain. And we've got eastern fish, we got blocks east of caches closed for cod spawning. They don't spawn out there. I mean, they're part of the roll enclosures, and fish don't spawn out there. I think it needs a look, and we need to look back and find out which ones were implemented for roll enclosures and which ones were for mortality reductions, and take it from there.
Tommy.
Yeah, I feel obligated to point out that when you go back and look at the record and you look what's written in the documents, all of these roll enclosures were justified as a way to reduce landings because the fish were aggregated. Now, there's a lot of discussion that says they're aggregated because that's the time to spawn. But, there's two different issues which need to be examined. The first is, were we trying to reduce landings or were we trying to prevent interfering with spawning activity? And I think if you go back and look at the record, while many of the roll enclosures may match up with spawning activity, they were really justified in all those earlier actions as a way to reduce landings. The analyses done by the PDT went back and looked at landings by 30-minute square, and we picked the month block combinations that had high levels of landings. And it's actually not until, we first started doing roll enclosures in, I'm not sure if it was framework 20 or 25, but it doesn't even mention spawning activity until like framework 27 or framework 30, when the closures had already been in place for several years. So, which isn't to say that the spawning activity isn't a concern. It's just that I'm not sure we really made those arguments in the documents when we implemented those particular closures.
Okay, anything else on universal exemptions perspective? Rodney.
Yeah, I just want to make it clear. I says closures. I mean spawn enclosures. If it was for reduction of landings, I don't have a problem with that, Oprah. But spawn enclosures, I do. I almost got my throat cut. I remember that night. I almost got it cut. The same people have pat me on the back today. I don't want them to go cut it again.
Okay. Anyone else in the council? Sally?
On the universal exemption, I think given the kind of development of these ideas that's happened since the last committee meeting, that we should take rural enclosures off the list of universal exemptions. I think it's going to be somewhere in between, but it clearly doesn't belong on the list of universal exemptions. So I would move that to eliminate rural enclosures from the list of universal exemptions for sectors.
Second. Seconded by Rodney. Any more discussion? Mike Leary.
I agree that maybe the first rounds of rural enclosures might be taken off the list, but we had 1 month, and that didn't seem to work, so we added a month to either end of it. And, maybe we can re-examine which months are important for spawning and which months should be left open. We're losing a lot of access in the Ipswich Bay in April, where there's very little cod in the beginning of the month, and there's a lot of haddock. So, maybe we should just re-examine it instead of just taking it out.
Anyone else in the council? Tom Neese.
What the heck? The issue here is, the initial idea is that NIMS wanted to have universal exemptions to try and minimize everybody's workload and to make things a little more consistent. And the issue that's been discussed here, I think, is that people are not convinced that all rolling closures should be exempt. And so we've got a motion on the board that takes rolling closures off the list of universal exemptions completely. And so now we're back to the point where we've got another thing where each individual sector is likely to come in and ask NIMS to be exempt from a particular rolling closure, which, they may potentially all argue that a different rolling closure doesn't protect spawning fish, and now the services has got to evaluate each one of those. There may be some advantage in something along the lines of what Mr. Leary said, is that, somebody come up with a list and identify which rolling closures are actually protecting spawning aggregations, and then come back and say, okay, we're either going to eliminate all of them or we're going to eliminate just this, or we're going to allow you to request an exemption from these specific ones that don't protect spawning fish, we'll give a universal exemption for the ones that we don't think protect spawning fish. I guess my point is, if you adopt this motion, are you turning everybody back to the point where they come in individually and ask for an exemption from a specific closure?
I'd say yes.
Yeah, and I don't know if that's the route we want to go. That's all I'm saying.
Council? Dave Gatham?
I do think it's the route we want to go. It may not be comfortable, but there isn't data on every block, quite frankly. There's all those blocks out to the east that we don't have a lot of information on, and that's going to be much more of a judgment call. We do actually have good information on all the western blocks now, the western two blocks, two closest to shore. But I think we're going to need to examine this, and the service in consultation with the council will probably have to decide on a block by block basis, and then anybody who applies for that block may be able to access that one. But I don't think we're going to be able to just sit here tonight or even next week and say, okay, these blocks should be open all the time and those blocks should be closed all the time. It isn't that black and white, unfortunately. It's going to take some doing. So I do support the motion.
What else in the council? Pat?
It's not clear to me that the message from this motion isn't that we wouldn't entertain exemptions. Yeah, so I don't think we're going back to a block-by-block sort of review of it. I think you know, the decision is that, that road enclosures are not on the table for exemptions. I mean, that's the way I would interpret it.
Jim Arlen.
Yeah, I'm opposed to the motion because I would like to see us take a little bit of attack of what Tom Neese laid out, is that let's have somebody look at these, see if there's a few that we definitely don't want to grant an exemption. And there may be a few, three, four, five, that can have an exemption. And I think to do this is just a little bit premature. I'd like to see the data and see some information that we have on some of these blocks and why they were closed in the first place. So I just think we need to do a little more work on it. Otherwise, we'll get into that situation where everybody's asking for an exemption for this block, that block. And maybe a few we can get. That's all.
Sally?
Yeah, I think the flip side is premature, given the information that we have on some of the blocks in the roll enclosures, that they do, in fact, serve to protect spawning cod. So if we give a universal exemption, then we know that we're going to be allowing fishing in area where cod aggregate to spawn. So that's what's premature. And, you know, having a blanket exemption for these areas is, I think that's, you know, that's what the debate was before this motion went up, is that we know that some of the areas are appropriate, and therefore a blanket exemption does not make sense.
Dave.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to make sure I'm clear on what Pat said. Because I think what Sally's doing is probably right. If we can go the other way around, is that what you're basically saying? So that if we do look at blocks on a block-by-block basis, that if there's one that perhaps justified a universal exemption, we could grant that on a block-by-block basis? Was that the gist of what you were saying?
Not in this action. I mean, no. I was not suggesting that we review it on a block by block basis to make a determination. I was agreeing that at this point that we would just remove rolling closures from the list of universal exemptions and that they not be on the table for exemptions on a case by case basis either.
Rodney.
Well, then that's very different than what I figured it to be. Because we're just taking this out of the universal, that it's there. But if we can prove that there's a block that's not doing nothing, there's no spawning activity in that block, then there's no reason that block should be closed. That's the way I'm taking this. It's just the universal. It's a blanket. We're taking the blanket off. That's what I'm entailing in this.
Yeah. Just trying to think it through. I'm not thinking very clearly right now anymore, but I guess if we were just silent on the issue of roll enclosures, then if in the future the council was able to show that there was a block that should not be included, then we could consider having it a universal exemption then.
Tommy's.
Yeah. Right now, the list of things that you cannot request an exemption from does not include rolling closures. So right now, a sector can come in and ask for an exemption from a rolling closure. We have tended to use the term rolling closure in the Gulf of Maine and seasonal closure for the May closure on Georges Bank, and there are sectors that are operating under exemptions from the seasonal closure on Georges Bank. So one question I have here with regard to this motion is, does it really intend to differentiate between the rolling closures in the Gulf of Maine and the seasonal closure on Georges Bank, or do people think we're applying this to both types of closures? The next point is that I think the language of the motion says different things to different people, and that's always problematic. You know, it says eliminate rolling closures from the list of universal exemptions for sectors, which Mr. Avila interprets to mean you could come in and ask for an exemption, but it's not automatic. Ms. Kirkle seems to interpret this as saying, you know, we're taking exemptions of rolling closures off the table completely. In my mind, if that's what you want to do, then the motion should say to eliminate rolling closures from a list of possible exemptions for sectors, or rather, a better way to word it the way the amendment is, it would be to say to add it to the list of things you cannot be exempted from. And, you know, it bothers me a little bit that we can all look at the one motion and read it two different ways. So I think we want to work on making sure that we know which closures we're referring to and whether it means you can or cannot ask for an exemption from a rolling from those closures.
Anyone else in the council? Frank Pump.
Thank you. I look at it, too, as if you would make a universal exemption for rolling closures for sectors. I'm surprised Coast Guard is still here. You now have something that's totally unenforceable because the only people that are going to be in the closure are going to be the common pool vessels. And if you end up with 50% of your fleet or higher that are exempt from it, you no longer have an effective closure. So if you're going to have an exemption to a rolling closure for universal for all sectors, you might as well just take that closure off the table totally. So if you could determine that a block shouldn't be closed for the sectors, it probably shouldn't be closed for anybody, which means you're probably going to have to crank down days at sea or some other measure because that mortality tool is no longer valid.
Dave Prebble.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a really important issue, and I have to be honest. My head isn't clear enough right now to make a proper decision on this. I don't know about anybody else, but I really would like to give this some thought. I think it's an important issue.
I agree with you. I think that the whole issue of universal exemptions, this is the first cut that the committee took at it, if I'm correct. And I think it's best to leave the list standing the way it is right now. We've had a pretty good discussion about a specific item in here and about what a universal exemption means and what it means if it's not on the list. And also Tom brought up that there are four items right now under Amendment 13 that are prohibited from asking for exemptions. And I think people need to familiarize themselves with that. There's currently a list of prohibited issues. We're talking about putting together a list of universal issues as well. And how those work for sectors. We do have a motion on the board. Dr. Pierce.
I would, in light of what's been discussed here, I would move to postpone indefinitely.
Seconded by Jim Salisbury. Okay. All those in favor, please raise your hand. Eleven in favor, opposed. Three opposed. Okay, the motion to postpone indefinitely carries. Anything else, Rip?
I laughed at that last one. I'm not sure, Mr. Chairman. I think everybody got a copy of a request that came through to the committee. From the Cape Cod Commercial Hook Fishermen's Association. That was received at our last committee meeting. And at that meeting, the committee did pass a motion to recommend to the council that the council request from the service that the council request that the service institute emergency action to put this in place. Quite frankly, I think that there are, you know, since we have passed that motion, there has been some additional discussion on this. While I should just bring the committee motion forward and let the council either go thumbs up or thumbs down. I think that there is some discussion that should be had on this. I'm just not sure that at this point in time, that we want to necessarily have that, and whether we should say that we've got this and that it will be an item that will be considered at the next council meeting. But it's I put it out to the council.
Well, I think you just put the motion up on the board and you either vote it up or vote it down.
emergency. Yeah.
We went through this in October with a monkfish emergency action request on that one-day meeting we had in October for a scallop discussion. Go ahead, Jim.
Is this such an emergency request that it can't be dealt with in a week and a half or 2 weeks or whatever it is? That it seems to me this is a significant request, this significant amount of claims put forward of why it's an emergency and what it is, and I think it's very difficult at this point in time to shift gears and to give it justice that it deserves.
Mr. Chairman, if you want, I can put the motion up, and then council can take action on it. Obviously, there are several choices, either thumbs up, thumbs down, or I assume that somebody could make a motion to table it to the next meeting. But on behalf of the Groundfish Committee, I move that the council consider the request to have the Service Institute emergency action as requested by the Cape Cod Commercial Hook Fishermen's Association concerning the expansion of the closed Area 1 haddock SAP.
That was a committee motion. Discussion on the committee motion. Jim Salisbury.
Just no apparent discussion. I would move that we table this till the February meeting of the council.
Is there a second? Seconded by Rodney. All those in favor to table till the February council meeting, raise your hand. Two opposed. Motion's tabled till the February council meeting. It's 8 o'clock. We need to vacate the room. See you in February.
Paul. Oh.